Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley, and also on Periscope, at Total Tutor. And let the continued amazing celebrity interviews continue. I'm excited to welcome the program NBA star and Memphis Grizzly, Mario Chalmers. Mario, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Mario. And how are you enjoying Memphis? I have memories of back in the days in Memphis when I was a professional wrestler. It's a fantastic city. What do you think of it so far?
It is a great city. It's really down to earth down here. I'm still trying to get used to this cold weather coming from Miami, but everything else is good.
Yeah, that's the only thing is the cold weather. But at least it's not as cold as Pittsburgh right now, where it's like 10 below zero. I don't know what's the weather like in Memphis right now, but it's very, very cold in Pittsburgh. So, Mario, take us back. I wanted to go a little bit back to your college days for a second. For our listeners out there, where did you play college basketball and go to some of the college story before we go to the pro story?
I went to the University of Kansas, or Kansas University.
So you were a Jayhawk. So what did you think of your – so what made you decide to become a Jayhawk, Mario? Where are you from?
I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. So the deciding factor really was Coach Self and, you know, just the Kansas atmosphere. You know, going there on my college recruiting visit, I had a great time, and they really accepted me, and they made me feel like I was at home already.
And that's the awesome thing about it. Once you feel at home, it's time to go ahead and do it. So you sign with Kansas – and tell me how the atmosphere of playing in Kansas. It must be an amazing college atmosphere, isn't it?
It is. I mean, those fans, 16-3, they pack the arena every night. They pack the field house. And, you know, there's no fans like Jayhawk fans. You know, they show up whether it's rain, snow, or anything. They're always there.
And they definitely are great, and they're awesome fans, and they definitely are loyal to their team. And it's like being on a professional team in Kansas, right? It's all Kansas basketball. When you talk basketball, it's about basketball, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Just because basketball originated there. So, you know, with Dr. Naismith starting everything there and being one of the first coaches at Kansas, it really has a lot of tradition, a lot of history.
So tell me your greatest highlight. What do you think were your fondest memory playing at Kansas?
Of course, the 2008 National Championship, you know, that'll go down to number one, me being in Kansas. But just the time of, you know, getting to know my teammates, playing with them, and, you know, just having a great career throughout those 3 years I was there.
So winning a national championship, that's just, again, when you think about it, your next goal definitely, is, I'm sure, is continued success in the NBA. But tell me specifically about winning a national championship with Kansas in the Final Four atmosphere. It must be absolutely just astounding to play in the Final Four.
That's one of the best stages that you ever went through. You know, you dream of that, being in that stage as a kid, and, you know, to actually be there and go through it and see the process and go through winning the whole thing. It's a dream come true.
It definitely is, and then cutting down the nets and saying you are national champions, and that's something that you'll never forget, and Kansas will always remember you. So when you got entered into the NBA draft, were you definitely thinking you were going to get drafted by Miami? Was that, or were other teams very interested as well when it was coming time for the draft?
I didn't think I was going to get drafted by Miami. Actually, I didn't have a workout with them during my pre-draft workout. So Miami wasn't even on my mind or on my list of teams. And it just happened to work out that way. And, you know, I'm thankful for it.
So you become a member of the Miami Heat. So you have to take me back again, Mario. I remember you being part of that amazing, about playing for the Heat and the amazing team that it was. When did you join the Heat? What was your role with the team specifically during that time you were with the Heat?
I joined the team in 2008. My role was, I was a rookie then. I was the starting point guard for the team. And, you know, we went to the first round of the playoffs. We lost to Atlanta in 7 games. But my team was really just to get everybody, I mean, my job is really to get everybody involved and, you know, be aggressive and do the things I do well on the basketball court.
And with the Heat, playing with that, the amazing players on that team, you learned a lot, didn't you, playing with the Heat?
I did. I learned a lot. You know, being a pick the minds of LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, you know, you learn a lot. And with those basketball, with all the experiences they've been through, it really helped me out as a player.
And what do you think you learned most from LeBron, especially how much of a leader on the floor he is? What do you think playing with him you learned from him?
You know, just the extra work you got to put in. You know, just be one of the greatest players that he is. He's really down to earth, and he really works at it. And, you know, his work ethic is incredible.
And then playing with that and then having – you've had a pretty great career, Mario, when you think about specifically two NBA titles and a national championship. Not many people can say they have won that many titles, you know?
Yeah, it's a list of a little few, so I'm glad to be part of that list. And hopefully I keep going.
Exactly. So now the new journey with Memphis and with the Grizzlies, and definitely excited for the challenge, aren't you, of going to being part of Memphis now, for sure.
I definitely am. You know, it was good to come out here and, you know, how the fans really have my back now ever since they forgot about the shot at Kansas.
So they forget that now. Or some of them. Some might not forget, right, Mario?
They might not forget, but they forgive a little bit. So that's a good thing about it.
For you to be able to now come into the Grizzlies organization and that now help them, that'll be forgotten, hopefully, for the time, for sure. And tell us specifically how the team's doing now. I know you had a game-winning shot, and how have you been doing, and where are the Grizzlies right now for our listeners out there that are not really keeping track of how teams like Memphis is doing right now?
We're doing good. You know, we're 5th seed in the West right now. We had a game yesterday versus New Orleans on Martin Luther King Day. We won that game. So, you know, we're getting better each and every day and making that playoff push.
And definitely. And when I think about – you think about specifically the West. You were part of the East, and the East has some, you know, superpower teams. You got the Cleveland Cavs. You got you guys. You got – there was not – as many powers. You go West, and every night is a big-time game, isn't it, in that conference?
Yeah, you got to be ready to play. You know, the West is a tough conference, so you got to be ready every day.
And what have you learned differently, specifically of the play of style, playing in the West compared to the East? What do you think differences and stuff?
The West is more up and down. The paint's more open, more freely. And you get more time to do what you can do.
Definitely, and it's something that when you're up and down floor, that's perfect for a point guard, right? You get to be the leader on the floor general and just start running, and that's what you want to do, for sure, and make it
exciting. Yeah, you
want to
get the ball and go, so that's a good thing about it.
And playing against teams like Golden State and stuff, you got to go up and down that floor, don't you? Or before you know it, it's...
Definitely.
You never know what's happening. So, Mario, I know another thing, you definitely giving back is an important part of the legacy you want to live. Tell us specifically about your foundation.
The Mario V. Chalmers Foundation. You know, we've been up and running since 2008. And, you know, we support the Research of Breast Cancer and Youth Initiatives, you know, just trying to get the kids off the street and the positive things in the community.
Great. And how great has it been to have a foundation and be able to give back to people, for sure?
It's been great. You know, something I've always wanted to do ever since I was a little kid. And, you know, being in the position I'm now is a perfect opportunity to give back.
It definitely seems like it's a time to give back, for sure. And I'm sure you're learning specifically how a foundation's run and how it's something for you to take with you after your career is over in basketball. So you're learning specifically the business nuances of how to run a foundation. Am I correct?
Definitely. You know, being involved with my foundation every day, make sure everything's going right. And it's a lot of work.
Definitely a lot of work, Mario. And you have a great team around you to keep it going, right? especially when you're on the road and traveling all the time and playing? Who are some people that really help you out for your foundation?
You know, my mom's a big part of my foundation. One of my best friends, Doug Hardy, helps a lot with my foundation. And my sister, my dad also. So it's really my family's really involved in it.
Definitely. And that's the great thing, is to have family and different people, and it gives back to the community, and you know it's important, and you guys are making a difference. So it keeps you wanting to go to work every day, especially when you're working for your foundation. Now, Mario, also you have some different sponsorship endorsements right now. Can you tell me a little bit about some of those as well?
I just signed an endorsement deal with Nike. You know, it's a shoe company I've always wanted to be a part of, so I finally got that done. And then I'm working with this shot tracker crew. You know, they're helping me with my game and perfecting my shot and giving kids an easier way to, you know, track how many shots they shoot a day and their percentages and how many makes and misses they have.
Do you like, Mario, how the game's changing now, where the big man, even though I'm a big man, I play college basketball only Division III, but I'm 6'10", how now it's really becoming, the game is becoming more of a three-point game and the outside shooting game compared to the days of which we always inside first, then outside, and how important the outside shot is now in development?
It's definitely changing the game. You know, being able to shoot the three is the way of the game now, and it's making the game a lot more fun to play.
What recommendation would you give young people for shooting, the shooting style, shooting the ball and stuff, and the practice to become a great shooter?
You know, just work on it every day. When you're out shooting, shoot the shots that you're going to take in the game. And, you know, always remember to keep your elbow in and follow the mechanics.
Definitely, and keep the elbow in and the mechanics. And you wish that you really push how important some fundamentals are. I'm sure, like you said, playing with the Heat, playing with LeBron, you develop such great work ethic, and playing for Kansas, that you got to live in the gym. The day's not over after the game. It's time the next day. Back to practice and get back working on your shot and working on those fundamentals, isn't it?
Yeah, you got to work on it every day. It's never a day off.
Never a day off. So, Mario, where's the best place we can find information on you? And best of luck the rest of the season. It's great to hear the Memphis is definitely on the right track for a goal that's to win another NBA title for yourself and bring the Grizzlies back all the way to hopefully an NBA championship at one point in time. Where's the best place we can find information on you, Mario, and learn more about you?
You can follow my Twitter, mchalmers15, or you can go to my website, mariovchalmersfoundation.com, and it has everyday updates, so you can find out things on there.
All right, so best of luck this season. I hope to see that you guys can go far in the playoffs, and I'll be rooting you on, and I guess go Jayhawks as well. So thanks again for calling.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, take it, Mario. See you later. Okay, bye-bye. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google+, and also on Periscope, at TotalTutor. And I've had the celebrity on twice. We had really long conversations, and so I'm excited to welcome the program New York Times best-selling author, Celebrity Apprentice winner, former Entertainment Tonight host, and much, much more, Lisa Gibbons. Lisa, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm doing just great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Lisa, when you were on The Celebrity Apprentice, I was rooting for you. I said, wow, somebody that had such long conversations about her charity, I was just rooting for you from the beginning to the end, watching the show, saying, I want to see her win for sure. So I'm sure that still, at that time, how you were able to raise so much money for your charity, it must have been such an amazing experience.
Well, first of all, thank you, because I feel like all of you that have been so kind and generous to let me share that part of my life were really right there with me. It was the coolest thing, and I'm excited because the show is back in production with Arnold, and I'm supposed to go back and be a consultant, you know, how like Joan Rivers was on our season.
Yes.
So I'm excited about that, but it changed everything for our charity. I took my earnings and opened up what we call Lisa's Care Connection in my hometown, And so we're now offering our free services to the friends and neighbors that I grew up with in South Carolina, and my dad's all involved with it. So
awesome.
It's just been an amazing opportunity.
And it definitely, for someone who is so giving as you are and how much time you give back to the community, to have that opportunity and that platform has just taken it to the next level. And I'm happy to know that the show will be on with Arnold, and I can't wait to hear more about that. And I'm sure I'll have you on possibly to promote that when that time comes. But what you were talking about today is, again, you talked about what you had to do with your mom, now you're with your father, and what happened to him. And the organization that you're promoting right now, Phillips Healthcare, tell me a little about the product and how important it is to save people's lives.
Thank you for that. You know, you never know what's going to happen. I didn't think we were going to have my dad to be involved with our work going forward a year ago. But I always love how Robin Roberts says, you know, make your mess your message. And that's really what we've chosen to do. You know, Daddy was always this larger-than-life, invincible hero of mine. And so when he made it to age 85 without having ever been in a hospital and was just very, very healthy. But he got this freak thing happened. He got stung by a swarm of yellow jackets. And the venom, he had a reaction to the venom, goes to the ER where they said, buddy, you've got coronary heart disease. You need to have bypass surgery like today. He said, no. I'm not doing it, you know, stubborn, probably afraid, and just made the choice no. So as much as we wanted to convince him as his kids, we had to honor this as his life. But I said, Dad, if you're going to live alone on the lake, that's what he does. I said, I don't feel secure unless you've got some kind of support. And I know you don't want a care provider living with you and all that. Let's get you a personal medical device. Got him a Phillips Lifeline. Okay, fast forward 3 years. I'm paying the bill every month, just hoping he's wearing it, hoping the thing is working. We get the call. He hit the floor in a heart attack.
No.
Was crawling to the bed, and had he not, or the girlfriend actually forced him to push the button for Phillips to signal help, we wouldn't have him. So now he's got the newer version of that, which is this GoSafe technology, where let's say he passed out on that fall, or he was disoriented or couldn't reach his button, it's got automatic fall detection. It will signal for help for you. And wherever you are, if he had a wreck in his car, if he hit his head on his boat in the middle of the lake, wherever you are, they can send help. Isn't that cool?
I think it's so great because you have a situation where you have a loved one that wants to still be independent, wants to do all these different things. Yet, if they're left alone and an emergency happens, there's going to be someone to get them, to help them. And that's so key, especially when you're alone. My father has fallen a few times when my mom has been watching my kids at my house. And that's something I'm going to definitely recommend for him as well, because once he's on the floor, he can't get back up, Lisa. So,
well, that's right.
He has to wait. Yeah.
Well, you know, and even for people that are traveling, you know, if you're in another state, if you're on a bus, you know, wherever you are. And I think that's great peace of mind. And no one sees that you're wearing this. It's like a little necklace. And so it's tucked underneath your clothes. But if you press the button and you can just say, the operator will come on and say, you know, Miss Gibbons, do you need help? And you can say, no, I'm just checking to make sure you're there. If you just want to know that, okay, great, I'm connected to somebody, or there's a storm, do you think they're going to evacuate the neighborhood? I'm a little worried. You know, I'm on the bus. I think there's somebody, a character in the back that looks suspicious. Will you just, you know, make sure I know that you're there? They'll talk to you. They'll work.
That's
great. I just think it's a beautiful support to give you great peace of mind.
Lisa, talk to you as well, not just alert, but talk to you.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times the nerves of people who have had an accident, they're just so concerned, and they worry so much. But if they have somebody that is there to through that process, if they're falling, they can't get up, or, you know, specific things, having that person there is huge, because that could lead to some other medical complication, right, Lisa?
That's exactly what often happens. And I've had a chance to talk to some of the Philips Lifeline operators, and they tell me with great smiles on their faces all the things that people call them for. Because you set up your system. Like, you can say, okay, if you get a signal from me, first call my son or first call my husband. Like, I have one, and I have them to call my husband first. Because if I'm out, you know, walking my dog, and I'm here in the hills in California, and I, you know, somebody comes up behind me, you know, I'm going to want to make sure that that somebody's going to know where I am. You know, I'm 10 blocks from home or whatever it is. So it's just a great option for people for all kinds of situations, people that have seizures or
yes.
That have panic attacks or any other reason that they want to know that they're connected to someone who can get them the help they need.
Yes, definitely. And it's at philipslifeline.com. People can find out more information and learn about the products and services they provide. Correct? philipslifeline.com. Correct?
That's it. And when you go there, you'll see my beautiful friend Betty White, who has had a Philips Lifeline for years. And
uh-huh.
I said, Betty, nobody knew you had this. And she's like, well, that's because you can't see it. But she lives really independently. She doesn't have family. She lives by herself. And while she's really super busy, you know, she doesn't want to call on people. She wants to take care of herself. And so she does.
And so you have a lot of other big things coming up. Your book is coming out in April. I hope to get a chance to interview you about your book in April. And also the Rose Parade as well. So a lot of different things coming up, Lisa. Where's the best place we can connect with you as well? Where can we go?
Well, if folks are on Twitter, I'd love to connect with you there. I'm at Lisa Gibbons, and that's my website too, lisagibbons.com.
Well, Lisa, it was great connecting with you, and hope to have you back on again. And I'm rooting for you, and I look forward to watching you on the new Celebrity Apprentice as well, and see how you provide great help for the other celebrities to help their charity. So thanks again for calling.
Thank you. I'm excited about it, too, and I've enjoyed talking with you as well. Take care till next time.
All right, Lisa. Take care. I'll see you later.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, that was the Total Celebrity Show. Take care, everyone. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, Tolter.net, for more information. Twitter, Tolter, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Tolter, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, and also on Periscope, at Total Tutor. And I'm honored to have on the program David McCallum, who plays Dr. Donald Ducky Mallard on NCIS, and also is known from The Man from U.N.C.L.E., David, thanks for calling, and how are you?
What a pleasure to be with you, Neil. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, David. And really quickly, two quick questions about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I was talking to my mother today saying I was going to interview you, and she, when I brought up your name, the first thing that came about was The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and you're really known for that part. Tell us a little
Absolutely.
Bit about that role.
Yeah, well, you know, Ducky, in a way, has taken over from Ilya, because you have to think in terms of time more than anything else. It's 50 years ago, 51, 2,
right.
3 years, whatever, since we did The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I know that, because that's when I met my wife, Catherine, and we've been together for 50 years, married for 49
oh,
of them.
That's great. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm able to put things into a slight perspective. Donald Ducky Mallard came on the scene 13, 14 years ago and is still going strong. So it's quite extraordinary how it depends how old you are. If you watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E., if you're old enough, then you know about it. But 60%, 70% of the populace of this country have never heard of it. I mean, never saw it. I have no idea what it was.
Oh, cool. So what was the role that you played on that show? Tell me the premise of that real quick.
Of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Yeah, The Man, yeah.
It was at the time of the Cold War, the Vietnam War. This country was in turmoil. because there was many people who were protesting the war, and it was a very, very difficult time for the psyche of the country. And all of a sudden comes a program which, as they say, had tongue in cheek. They had a certain humor to the whole thing, where a Russian agent, played by yours truly, and an American agent, played by Robert Vaughn, are sent off on missions by Leo G. Carroll, who is a very beloved American actor. And the whole thing allowed people just to get away from the realities of the situation. And I think that was the success of the show. It was the fact that we made fun, to a certain extent, of world affairs.
Cool.
And the odd thing is that you now have NCIS, which is doing exactly the same thing. I mean, we deal with the situation in the Middle East, with terrorism, with the Marines, with everything, we're fighting the war. And lo and behold, it's the sort of same thing over again in an odd way.
Were you surprised that once you got the part of playing Dr. Donald Ducky Mallard that NCIS would have such success when you first auditioned?
I was one of the people in the beginning. I look around and see the talent. I'm surrounded by that cast and that crew who'd been together with JAG and other things. And just I realized that this was an enormous strength to what we were doing. And I said to you know, this show's going to go to number one. And everybody said, oh, yeah, wishful thinking. But I was right. It went to number one, you know, a few years later. And stayed there, and it's still there. And the fact that the NCIS is reaching its 300th show, and we're still number one drama in many parts of the world, including the United States, it is just amazing. And it's so gratifying to be a part of it.
And to think to be on two successful shows in your career, spanning such a long period of time, it's great, and I think that's fantastic. Now, how do you have time to write a book? That's the thing. You're so busy doing the show. I talk to authors all the time, interview best-selling authors to authors just getting started, David. How did you find time to write the book?
Well, it took a long time. It's been many, many years since I basically sat down to teach myself how to write, how to put words on paper, because I was reading books on tape and thinking, oh, I can do this. But I was wrong. It's not that easy. And so over the years, the manuscript that I was working on that had begun, obviously I was out of work at the time, so it began with the actor being handed a suitcase with $1 million in it. That story morphed over the years into something that I finished about 3 years ago. And somebody read it and said, well, you know, you should do something with this. And from that time until the thing was published a couple of weeks ago, the whole thing just took off on its own. I'm as astonished as anybody else that I've actually published a book and that they're pressing hard for the second book. And in one case, somebody said, a series of books. I said, hold on a minute. I'm in my 83rd year. Don't push your luck.
All right, so for a short period of time, because I do end up interviewing authors for a long period of time on my author's show, Once a Crooked Man, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the premise is based on the fact that so much crime in this country is not caught. There are a lot of people who work in the crime industry and are very successful because they keep a low profile and they don't leave a trail behind them. So crime pays is one of the things about the book. The other thing is I have this rather charming actor who's a New York actor who he overhears a conversation and realizes that he's listening to some bad guys talk about killing somebody a long way off. But he decides to interfere. And by interfering, he screws up his life, everybody else in, you know, everybody's life. I mean, and meets some very, very fascinating characters along the way.
Oh, wow. So that really sounds great. And I think you're so happy about the feedback of your book so far by the people that have bought the book and have gotten to review it. You're blown away by that, too, I'm sure.
Well, it's very gratifying. And it gives you a little bit of confidence going into the second book because you say, and the people say to me, if you've done it once, you can do it again. Just get your butt on the chair.
Well, I hope that you can have continued success with the book, and I will reach out to your team at one point to get to talk to you maybe a little bit longer on a longer period of time about the book for my author's show, because I tell you what, I just really – 8 minutes is definitely not enough time for David McCallum. But where can we purchase the book, David, and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Just about everywhere, Barnes & Noble, various bookstores. It's been on Amazon for months. And that includes the audio book, the Kindle version. It's out there. If you just go, you know, Once a Crooked Man on the keyboard, it'll come springing up somewhere.
Oh, you come up everywhere for sure, David. And do you have any social media that people can follow you and stuff like that, or is the best place to Google you? Or do you have, like, Twitter or Facebook or anything?
I've been on Facebook for a while, and I have someone that helps me with that. But that's about all. I don't have any web. I personally don't have any websites. There are dozens of them out there in various places. They take me back to my childhood, practically. But no, Facebook's probably the best.
So we can Google you through NCIS, watch you on NCIS, and definitely can't wait to check out the book. And everyone needs to purchase the book again. Once a Crooked Man. David McCallum. And David, did you ever, when you played that in the man from Uncle, did you have a different voice for that part when you played
in the beginning? He definitely had a Russian accent. You know, you dropped the articles. So I'd played Russians in Britain before I came over to the United States. So it wasn't too hard. And then as the series went on, as he lived in America more, he became more and more, you know, anglicized. So the accent was dropped quite a bit.
Oh, do you have the accent at the beginning? Could you give us that impersonation quickly for a second?
Oh, Russians, not to the... You just have to think in terms of being Russian agent. I don't know if I can do it.
You know, you're going to get hired again, David, for this if Russia keeps getting back in the news. So keep that Russian accent going into your 90s, for sure, yeah.
Yeah. I can see Ducky Mallard adopting a Russian accent in Autopsy.
All right, David, good talking to you, and best of luck, okay, man?
You too. Thanks so much, Neil.
See ya. Okay, bye-bye. All right, take care, guys. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show. I'm the host of the show, Neil Haley. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, and also on Periscope, at TotalTutor. And I am such a huge fan of Storage Wars. A few months ago, I interviewed Dan and Laura Dotson. It was just a phenomenal interview. And now I'm excited to have another star from Storage Wars. So I want to welcome the firm from A&E Storage Wars, Renee, thanks for calling. How are you?
Hi there. Good. This is Casey. Renee's going to be calling in just a second.
Oh, okay, Casey. How are you? So
good, thanks. We're multitasking.
You're a surprise. See, I love surprises.
Oh, yeah.
I've been doing these for you being on the show. So fantastic. And now I see Renee calling in as well. Thanks for calling as well, and thank you so much for the surprise of Casey calling in as well. I love surprises.
Hi, Neil. Okay. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. So we got all of our minds. This is going to be interesting. All of us on the line together to discuss things. So let's go to the story of how you guys got involved in Storage Wars and then talk a little bit about, I guess, first of all, being involved in storage. Let's go with Renee first, and everyone can take their turn. First of all, how did you get into the storage business, Renee, or like interested in things or in storage places and stuff?
Well, first off, this is going to be really interesting because it's the first time that me and Casey actually do a radio interview, and we're not in the same location because, you know, me and Casey are like soulmates, and we really feed off each other, and it's really weird to talk and not having her next to me and just kind of working it. So this is first. So be gentle.
Oh, I'm there in spirit. We're multitasking, so you know I'm at the store and he's on his way to go buy a big deal. So that's why we're
team bargaining. Competitors might be listening. But anyway, to answer your question, how we got started in storage business. I used to buy and sell my whole life. My parents used to buy in Oxford. They used to go to old farmhouses, But like antique hunting and deals and buying and selling just kind of runs in our blood. And we started on eBay when it first started with Beanie Babies and business like that. And we used to go to the swap meets, and there was all these storage buyers all the time. They used to pull up in these big trucks, and they just would bring killer merchandise every week. And this one guy, actually a good friend of mine, Dave Ambrose, he always used to tell me, oh, yeah, we bought this for nothing. We bought this for nothing. They used to wholesale me stuff cheap. And I'm like, well, you know, these go for $200-$300 on eBay. And he's like, yeah, take them all, give me $100 a piece. And I was thinking, I'm like, if those guys can't afford to do that, don't even care about the extra $100 or $200 in multiple items, they must be making a lot of profit. So Casey got ready. We were going to a Del Mar racetrack, and I went to my first storage auction that was telecommunication equipment I bought for $800. And everybody was laughing. They were making fun of me, how they dropped this unit of me and ran me to the moon. And we sold part of it the next day for $3,900. And then we did probably over $10,000 within 2 months and over $20,000 within a year. So after that, I was hooked in the storage business.
And you got hooked. And you, again, didn't start on the show at the beginning. So did the show get you interested in trying to go and getting involved in these auctions?
No, because we've been doing it for almost 11 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay. So now when you were watching it, first of all, Casey, on your own, were you a fan of Storage Wars before you decided to try to be part of this? We'll find out the whole casting thing.
Oh, yeah.
Were you watching it before that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was exciting because, you know, it was depicting what we do for a living. So, yeah, it was exciting to see the finds and the battles.
And, Neil, we're just like the rest of America. What makes Storage Wars interesting, and this is kind of sick to us because we buy and sell every day. But at the end of the day, I see any kind of auction show or yard selling show or swap meeting show, just like the rest of America, we want to know what's in the damn box. So we watch all those shows.
That's wild, that for sure. And the growth of it, Casey, getting to become successful, going to auctions, it took a lot of homework, right, to find the right auctions, right, to become successful.
I'm sorry, man. Okay.
Yes,
sorry,
no,
let me answer that question.
No,
sorry,
I'm sorry, you answer the question. Okay.
It's not necessarily the right homework. There's two main ingredients. You have to work hard. You have to go to a lot of auctions. Sometimes I go to auctions for a week and I don't even make a single bid, or finally that unit comes and looks halfway decent and it just goes through the moon. So you have to attend as many auctions as possible. And then the key for our success is I buy big units that look good and they look like quality and pride of ownership. And when you see those units, you just pull the trigger. I just bought one 2 days ago for $4,700.
That's
wild. Yeah, definitely due diligence. You know, you just got to keep on plugging because you might see 100 units that are crap and then it just takes that one. So you got to have drive. And drive.
So Casey, how do you have that patience? Casey, how do you have that patience to do that, to decide that you're going to keep looking at different units and things like that and say, oh, man, this is a horrible unit. This is a horrible unit. And you end up some days going to auctions and wasting your time completely.
Well, you just have to remember that 80% of success is just showing up. So you just got to plug it in. You know, we're hard workers and stubborn, too. You just got to keep on trekking.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it's like any job. I mean, this is our job. This is how we pay our bills. And, you know, most of America goes to work, and they have bosses they don't like sometimes, or they got bad days at work, or the stuff doesn't go right. And sometimes it sucks, you know. I mean, I bought units for $3,000 where I'm starting to go through, and I'm looking through the stuff, and everything is just trash inside, and we have to load it. We have to go to the dump. We got to pay the dump, and you get hurt somehow, and you're just like, oh, this sucks. But then there are those days, and you guys seen it on Storage Wars with that episode in Torrance. I don't know if you watch them all, but we bought one against Dave Hester for $3,900, and, of course, he was making fun, like always. And on the show, we made over $50,000 in that locker. But in reality, we actually made a lot more money because there was just so much stuff in that locker, a lot of porcelain. We got cups from the Titanic. There was so much stuff that we couldn't show. It's probably going to be $100,000 locker. But when you get those lockers, they fuel your fire for a while.
That's wild, and I think that's, Casey, that what you see is you never know what treasures lying underneath or lying in those storage So,
one time when we lived in Vegas, we bought a unit and it looked like it was a household unit. Come to find out, it was a business that had gone under and it was a vitamin store. And all the boxes in the back were filled with, like, I don't know, 3,000 vitamins, and they were all current vitamins.
Oh, yeah, that's talk about up and downs of the business. It was supposed to be an Army Ranger and either gun training school. So people were saying there's going to be ammo, uniforms, you know, gun training equipment, all kinds of stuff that you can sell fast in Nevada legally. And I bought the unit, I can't remember, I think 2,800 at a time, which was really, at that time I was really high for luck, because it's way before the shows and stuff. And I got in there, and every box was filled of vitamins. And a lot of them were expired at first, and I was, like, totally bummed out. I'm like, man, I just spent $3,000 on vitamins. When we took them all to our warehouse, we started looking up. We had Japanese vitamins that were going on eBay for $15-$60 a bottle. We put them online, and they all sold immediately. That locker would probably made, I lost count, but a minimum of $20,000 or $30,000. And I was bummed out when I got it.
Because you thought, nothing, this is nothing, because you're not an expert, Casey, in everything that you see, and that could be a treasure. Right, Casey? So you could make the mistake of throwing something out that's worth a lot of money. So it's good to always look at each item and Google it and do all that stuff after you've won, so that you don't end up throwing out something that could be a huge treasure.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you, Renee has due diligence on doing research. He is amazing. I wish I could look inside his brain and see all the vast knowledge he has on different collectibles and just all the different items he has knowledge about. And, like, if he goes someplace and he sees somebody buy big on a certain item and he doesn't know it, he'll go home, he'll research it for however many hours it takes, and he'll come out and he'll be, like, an expert on that subject, and that will never happen again where he'll drop the ball and not know what that item's worth.
Wow.
So doing your research is key.
Oh, research is gigantic. In
success,
yeah,
knowledge
for sure.
Is power. Yeah.
Because you can, because if you're researching different items all the time, and then you're thinking of bidding on that locker, if you have more knowledge of what antiques look like and specific things before you even go to the storage unit, you're going to have much better success than some people that just are there like they're rolling the dice and gambling, you know.
Right.
Saying,
and
I'm
for myself, I'm more like the viewer, where I don't have the knowledge, but being in this business and watching everything Renee's bought over the years, you know, selling it in our store or selling it online, I've really acquired a big knowledge. So it's really, you know, finding the people who know what they're doing and, you know, kind of keeping an eye on what's going on.
So before we get into the story of the store, I mean, of being part of the show, Casey, how did you two meet? How did that tell that story?
Well, because, you know, Renee's so shy and quiet. Just kidding. No, we were standing in line in Starbucks, and he started to talk to me, and then he bought me a coffee, and it was Thanksgiving weekend, like 11 years ago, and 6 hours later, we really hit it off.
She took one look at me, and she was hooked. Let's just be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's those chance meetings and happening, and I'm sure, Casey, you've had those people always come up to you and try to talk to you about specific things. What made Renee's more of offering to buy a coffee more enticing to you, that you wanted to have a conversation?
He was just really charming and gregarious, you know, with his bubbly, happy self. And, you know, I'm attracted to people that are happy-go-lucky, and that's my personality. And then he bought me the coffee, and then he touched my hand, and he's all, come, let's go sit over here. And, like, usually I don't like guys to touch me, but when he touched my hand, it was, like, electric. It was synergy. And I just took one look at him, and I was just like, wow, like, something struck me. And to be honest with you, I'm a person of faith, and I totally feel like God put us together. And I just looked at him, and I was like, okay, I will go with you. And it was just from that moment on, we've been inseparable.
But see, that's a tremendous story. Now, Renee, tell us the story of how you got hooked up with the show. You've been watching it. You, as anyone that's in the storage business, meaning the auction business, says, I want, and you make money off this, she said, I'm going to watch this show to see these cast of characters. How did it happen that you got on the show?
Well, at the very first, when they were putting the show together, Dan and Laura Dodson of American Auctioneers, and now they have StorageAuctions.net, they were putting a lot of the cast together. They were telling people who should come on the show. And they told OP that, you know, we should come on the show. We're perfect. We're big buyers. When they started, we literally were just opening up our first store, the big store.
Uh-huh.
And we were super busy. Said, hey, you guys got to come on the show. And it's a TV thing. And, you know, in the beginning, obviously, there's not very much money and stuff. And I'm like, why would America watch us go through boxes? And I'm so used to the business that we're doing. That's a mistake in my life I made. I've never thought that to somebody that has a 9-to-5 job and goes to work and doesn't really realize what we do, we're modern-day treasure hunters. They love it, and they're hooked. So it just didn't work with the schedule. At first, we said, we just can't do it. It doesn't make sense. I'm opening up this business. I'm investing a lot of money, and we're going full-on retail. And I just can't do it. I can't have any other side project because it's a very demanding job. I mean, sometimes we drive 1,000 miles a week, and, you know, we film 4 days a week, sometimes 5 days a week. So it's a lot of work. So it just didn't work at first. Then by season three, all of a sudden, the show's a huge success. Our business is set up, and meanwhile, it's a huge success. We started talking to them again, and they started talking to us. But at that time, the show was so big, everything was running smooth. They weren't that happy. They were happy with everything. They didn't want to add any of the cast. And by season four, the executive producer changed. I think he came in season four, season three, Jeff Bumgarner. And we did some filming with the senior producer, Jeff Fry, before, and they really liked us. And then they said, hey, maybe we'll bring you guys on the show. And the schedule worked for us at the time. And so we did two episodes. And then they said, okay, now we have to send it to A&E and see what they think. And they just liked it. They thought we were a good fit. And we ended up doing 6 episodes in season 4, and then we were waiting. That's when Barry left afterwards. They weren't sure if they want to continue the show at the time because there's changes. And then they decided to do season 5, and we signed a contract. We've done every episode, and I believe season 9 is going to start airing in March, and it's just been successful. It had all
wow.
happened so fast, 3 years of our life. I've probably been working 80 to 100 hours a week between the show and our business. It's like it's all going by as a flash. But once everybody got together, which is like magic, I mean, we never looked back.
Wow. Okay, so let's go, Casey, to the experience now, the show. Once you got on reality television, how did your life change? Especially being recognized, different things.
Well, I think the funniest part, and any women that are out there listening, they'll understand this when you all of a sudden realize, oh, my God, maybe I can't leave the house without makeup on. So just feeling like, I know that sounds vain, but, you know, as a woman, you just kind of feel like you have to have your face on. So that was a little change because I'm a, like, down-to-earth kind of girl where, you know, I like to work out. I like to run errands after a workout and be sweaty and gross and running around doing mommy errands. And so that kind of took a change. But for the most part, it's been pleasant. You know, I always still get surprised when people recognize me where I'm like, oh, well, thank you very much that, you know. And people get really excited, and so it's nice to bring a smile to people's faces.
Hey, Renee, what about you and your situation where the show in general, getting your film, both you and Casey are being filmed and dealing with the cast of characters on the show, is that a challenge sometimes with filming and what's going to end up showing on TV and did I really do this? Kind of thing, getting used to that.
But what are you referring to specifically?
No, I don't know. Yes, I'm just saying, you know, just different fights, different, you know how reality television goes.
Yeah, you know, I guess the big difference between real life, like in real life, we're Christians, so if I don't like somebody, I just don't talk to them. Where on the show, we have to go ahead and we have to interact. So when I have to talk to Daryl, I have to talk to Dave. And, you know, Daryl, you know, and then we have bad feelings sometimes and it escalates. So that part I'm not too crazy about. But I mean, those are inner feelings. I just wouldn't share them in real life. And then sometimes you do weird stuff. And it's like we had one episode in Palm Springs where I'm educating, I'm talking about stuff. But one of the things that ends up making is when I'm kind of grabbing my stomach in a fat way, which I'm like, did I really do that? And that is so stupid. And why did it make the cut?
Wait,
but overall, you know, we trust Original Productions, and they put really good episodes together. So we enjoy watching, and we have fun. And then as far as being recognized, yeah, wherever I go, I mean, people recognize us, so it's weird. But the good benefit is because of it, we get to be involved in a lot of charity work. and we get to help them make a difference. I mean, this year we donated over 50,000 books to different organizations, brand new Disney books to kids organizations. We work with Adrian Paul and the Peace Fund a lot. So, like, it gives us all these opportunities where before we could do some, but not on this level. And then the best feeling, again, in the world, there's a lot of kids that watch the show and a lot of families. And when they come up and they meet us, they get really happy, which that part is still weird to me because I'm just a regular guy. But it seems like, and I get this told a lot, it made their day, and I take a few minutes and talk to them. And when I see them being happy just by being able to say hi to us or take a picture, that really makes me happy inside.
Right. Definitely.
Amen to that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about Dave Hester. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Dun, 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 dun.
Okay,
Black
and you guys
Cloud
are going to hear this. Ted and Laura hooked me up with you guys, and Dave's my favorite on the show. So here you
thank
go,
you.
Guys. No, because, again, here's my life. My life has turned upside down since my radio show 6 years ago. The Nature Celebrities app, my business, entrepreneurship. When you guys, when the show was the hottest, meaning when the first few years, I watched it a lot of times. I hardly have any time ever to watch television now. I have five kids, by the way, and I catch up on demand in specific shows, my wife and I. And there's not enough time in the day, you know that, with five kids to catch up on every show. So Dave, when the show was number one and was, you know, so popular at the beginning, it was so big, but then I could just see how he could grate on people's nerves. So how did he grate on your nerves, Casey?
My nerves?
Yes.
I just think, you know, we knew him before the show, and Renee and I always respected him as a business person because he had an immaculate store. He just was on top of his game, and slowly as the show has evolved, his personality has just kind of changed. He just kind of, it's like something bit him and it's ugly. And I always tell people, he's one character that we definitely have to pray for. But how does he wear on my nerves? I just ignore him. I'm just like, oh. And I'll leave it at that.
He doesn't wear that much on my nerves anymore because at the end of the day, like Casey said, we used to respect him. He was good at business. There's a lot of stuff I learned from him. Actually, he's one of the main reasons I did a store because in Orange County, he dominated the area. And I looked, okay, like I was doing the swap meet, and, you know, we used to have 10 people out there, and we used to do a lot. But I used to look at it like, okay, what makes him different of everybody else? And he had a store. And then we went to go look at his store, and it was a really nice store. But like she said, with the show, it changed a little bit. And when you compete against him, you get dark. And he was like that before, too. So every time I see him, I always think of a little kid, like having a little brother. And, you know, whatever you do, the little brother messes with it, or he messes with something. And then he just does that old little thing, nah, 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 nah. And that's kind of Dave. So when you outbid him on a locker, he's going to talk trash. And if he outbids you on a locker, he's still going to talk trash. So you can win. So I try not to get mad about it anymore. I like bidding against him. Like it gets my blood flowing because if I go to an auction, I just run everybody over. I get bored after a while. I like having a competitor, and you know, I like it when he's the backup bidder because I know he bids too when he sees something good. And same thing with Daryl too. He sees good, he bids. And then of course they always say, "I just dropped it on him. I just dropped it on him." But I bet it. If I would have stopped bidding, it would have been a great locker. So.
Casey, who do you get along as one of your? I know you guys get along with Dan and Laura. But who else do you get along with, Casey, on the show?
We really like Ivy. We respect him. He's a hard worker. He's a family man. And Mary's a sweetheart. She's a little goofy sometimes, but she's a sweetheart. So those would probably be my two favorites. If I had to pick a favorite, it would definitely be Laura and Dan, though. They're almost like family.
And why are they family? Did you know them before? You knew them before the show because they had an idea you would be perfect for the show, and it just didn't happen at first, right, Casey?
We've known them for like almost 11 years, also. So we've done business with them prior to the show happening, and then, you know, over the years we've worked with them more and more, and especially now being on the show, we've gotten really close, and like, you know, it's like Uncle Danny and Aunt Laura. And they're just really sweet people, and they're very personable, and they're like us.
Oh, they
like to laugh and have a good time, and they're also a family business. So like we can relate to them because they work hard as a family, and you know, trying to come on up just like us, working hard, and they have good family values like us.
And I guess, Renee, they're not prima donnas like some of the other people on the show, right?
How do I feel about them?
They're not prima donnas, Renee. They're not prima donnas, Dan and Laura, like some of the other people on the show.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. No, they're totally down to earth. You know, even with Daryl and Dave, I mean, I headbutt with them a lot, but I still respect them because they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? They're good at what they do. Even Ivy's good at what he does. He's just on a different level. He doesn't deal in the super high-end units. He does more the low-end units. But in that part is great. You know, some other people on the show were, they just, I'm not that crazy, but I don't think they know as much as they'd like to, as they think they do.
All right, Casey, a tip. I'm going to ask you and Renee tips about if you want to first be the first time ever to go out and do an auction. Now, Casey, what would you recommend if I decided I'm going to go out to my local storage unit and there's going to be an auction to prepare myself so I can make some money?
Okay, well, I always tell people the best thing to do is have a plan. If you really are going to buy something, what's your plan? How are you going to transport it? You know, do you have a truck? Are you going to rent a truck? Secondly, where are you going to sell it? Are you going to have a yard sale? Are you going to sell it on Craigslist? Are you going to sell it at the swap meet? What's your plan? Definitely have a plan and be prepared to work hard. Like, maybe half the stuff is trash. You have to throw it away. Then you also have to pay for dumping fees, you know? So, like, know your market. And then lastly, like, you don't have to spend big money like we do. We spend money, but we have a store. I mean, maybe take $50 to $300 that you're, you know, if you lose it all, it's not going to change your life, right? So go out there, buy a starter unit, a worker unit, do the work and see, you know, do you like this before you go out there? Because some people are like, oh, I'm going to save up money and I'm going to go out there and spend $2,000. Why would you risk that? That's like a lot of money. Why don't you just start small? $50 doesn't change your life, but hey, like, see, do the work and see if you like it. Because it's a lot of hard work. That's one part they don't totally capture on TV, how much hard work it is.
It seems like it. It definitely seems like it. And what would your tip be, Renee?
Well, basically everything Casey said. The only one thing I agree, if you have money and you're willing to spend it, but just only take money you're willing to lose it, I think it's much easier to buy lockers for $2,000, $3,000, and $4,000, really good-looking lockers, than work buying the lower-end units because those are junk units a lot of times. And you can make money, but they're worker units. You work a lot harder. So I like buying clean stuff. And but take money that you can afford to lose. And, you know, maybe the first few times just kind of go watch, get yourself familiar with the auctioneer, with the rules they have. See how other bidders are bidding, and kind of get a price range on different days. What do the high units go for? What do the low units go for? So when you finally do go out and you think you see a good deal, you get to know by past experience in the area if that's a good deal or not, because every area is a little bit different. And also one of the biggest important things that the show doesn't show as much, don't let your ego get involved. If you outbid me, I get that all the time. People come up. I had a guy run me to 6,600. He was just high-fiving because they were outbid. And I'm like, well, you just paid $6,600 in a locker that I thought was worth $3,000-$4,000 if I want to go crazy, $5,000. But I kind of just took it up, you know, because I needed stuff for the merchandise. But I have a business that makes money 7 days a week, and I'm okay with buying stuff sometimes just to break even, just if I see certain items that make the store look good. Where you have to resell it now in a yard sale or eBay. So, yeah, you outbid me. You got some high fives. But is that worth $2,000 or $3,000? I know better things. So don't let your egos get them off with the bigger buyers. Remember, at the end of the day, this is a business. You got to make money. And that's all really that matters at the end. It's the bottom line. So don't make it about egos or about trash talking or stuff like that. Because if you do that, I guarantee you will go bankrupt. I don't care how much money you start with.
One thing I learned when one time Renee went to one auction and I went to a different auction and I bought, and then I forgot the cardinal rule. Just because the boxes say what is in the box doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be in there. So be prepared for that. One time I spent like $700 and half the boxes were full of paper and trash. I was like, oh, no.
And, you know, off camera,
that's
I don't let my ego get
right
involved. Even off camera, I don't let my ego get involved. We just had I just flew to Sacramento and it cost me about $1,500 overhead with a friend of mine. And it was supposed to be a big auction, but there were a lot of people there. And people were happy to be bidding against me. And one guy's like, oh, yeah, I was outbid Renee. And so I'm like, okay, whatever. And it was a really far trip for us. And this guy spent like $60,000 on, I don't know, on 33 pallets. And he was so happy. And so I didn't buy. And then afterwards, people were, are you upset that you got outbid? Or are you upset you didn't buy? I'm like, it doesn't really matter. There's more auctions tomorrow. There's more auctions the next day. I don't have to buy. If I think the deal is good, I'm not going to buy just to prove who has a bigger bankroll. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, because you
end up with
a smaller bankroll at the end.
And Renee, sometimes you're going to lose, right? I mean, it's not easy to win an auction, especially if there's 20 or 30 people that show up for the popularity now. It's not.